Please open your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. And we're going to read the longest statement on marriage that we find anywhere in the Bible. Ephesians 5. I'll begin reading in verse 22. Ephesians 5, 22. Ephesians 5, 22. Here's what it says. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. Verse 27, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now, as I said, this is the longest statement that we find anywhere in the Bible on marriage. And if you look at the ideas that you find there, what you realize is that these ideas are very politically incorrect in lots of different ways. In fact, I would say that if somebody decided, say, some popular artist decided to write a love song based upon Ephesians 5, 22 and following, that love song would plummet, the popularity of the artist would go down because these are unpopular ideas. And the reason that they're unpopular is because marriage in our culture and marriage in our church has been under attack in recent days and years, unlike any other time in all of human history. And you and I have been affected by it. We may say we haven't been, we may say we're above it, but we're all affected by the pressure and the changes and the messages, both subtle and overt, that come through our culture about marriage. Which is why every once in a while we need a month like this on marriage and the family where we can come back and we can talk about these things. We can come back and we can talk some on love and romance and marriage and weddings and raising children and ultimately God's plan for us in all of us. So I want to be very clear from the beginning what my purpose, my aim in this whole series. I am trying to do something for you and for me and for us as a church. And what I want to do is I want to stop the slide that we have in our culture and in our own minds away from what the Bible says God's foundation for marriage is all about. And I want to stop that slide. And instead, I want us in this month to come back and be challenged in our own minds to what God says, to his foundation. And even if we don't like it, and even if it's not politically correct, and even if you're not going to hear it in any song on the radio, it is what God says. And at some level, if God says it, we have got to decide. If God says it, then we're all in. That's what this month is about. And in many ways, it's really hard for me to talk to you about marriage because here in this room today, you know, we'll have, you know, 450, 500 people. Think of all the different marriage and family situations there are in our church. There are a lot. We have some here that have been married more than 60 years. And I think Bert and Dot, didn't you guys just celebrate, was it 64, 68? I can't remember. 67. 67 years. I mean, that's a long time. Good job, guys. 67 years. All right, so we have some that have been married for 67 years, but we also have some that are in their first years of marriage. We have both that are here. We have divorced and single people. We have divorced and remarried people. We have grandparents that are raising grandchildren. We have those that would rate their marriage as fabulous, and we have those that would say, Scott, if you knew what happened behind the closed doors of my house, you'd be surprised. And we have both that sit here every week. We have those that have been so hurt by a spouse that literally in a month on Marriage and the Family, they will not come to church the entire month because of their hurt. We have those that I know of that are considering legal action right now to walk away from their marriage. And they sit here with us. We have those who have children who have walked away from the faith. And it hurts them to sit and talk about the family. And we have others who seemingly impossibly have the miracle of kids that go on with the faith and are following the Lord. And we sit here side by side. We have those that have been estranged from their family for so long that they don't even want to think about family. And holidays and birthdays are so hard for them. And of course, we have those, maybe all of us, that have been affected by this cultural change regarding same-sex marriage. And we have moms and dads that have had to decide, what are we going to do with our kids? And we've had grandparents have had to decide, when I'm invited to my grandson's wedding to marry another man, do I go? So as nice and easy as it is to say, hey, let's talk about healthy homes and let's talk about God's plan, it's difficult. And, you know, we can skate along and try to pretend like everything is easy, but it's hard. And it seems like as the years go along, it gets harder. So if I say something in this series that you feel like, oh, that's just a gross oversimplification or some big overgeneralization, just know that we have so many different cases that are here. And I'm trying to, the best I can, address these issues. But many of us are facing very difficult bumps in the road in our families right now. And I want to be honest with you along the way, and I want to be as helpful as I can on what God has to say. So a few weeks ago, I drove to Dallas to do a wedding for my nephew. He was kind of the first niece-nephew in the family to get married and had a great time. But I want to tell you some things I think about weddings. Now, if you hear some people laughing over here, it's my family, because I whine about these things all the time at home. But let me just run with a little bit of a rant about why I don't like weddings. Okay? Can I just like run down the road and you guys give me a little bit of grace as I just like tell you what's in my heart and amuse you a little bit with my rant about weddings? And where I'll begin is with a Google search. How much does the average wedding in America cost? Now, how about somebody from over here? Take a guess. Average wedding in America. Throw out a number. How much? $125,000. Wow, that's a lot of money there. How about somebody over here? A guess. Too much. 30. Okay, so the average in America, according to Google, and of course Google knows everything and can't be wrong, $30,000 for a wedding, okay? That's the average in America, which means, of course, Jody, there are some that are way more expensive, and then the Dutch people that are way less expensive, right? Because we only want to spend like a buck, all right? So $30,000. Now think about that. My first house only cost $60,000. $30,000 would have been half the cost of my house for one day. Let's just be honest, it's one day. I have a friend, he was in my youth group years ago, and he does destination wedding photography. And he does all these weddings, flies all over the world, and his clients spend $100,000 or more, that's like getting started to do the wedding. $100,000 for a wedding, and they fly him all over the world to take pictures. That's what he does. Now, to be totally unfair, we all know that the more a couple spends on the wedding, the more in love they are, right? No, okay, that's not right. The more they spend on the wedding, the more likely it is they'll stay together. No, that's not right either. The larger the engagement ring diamond, the more he must love her. No, that's not right either. See, some of you men are going, that's right, you keep going. That's good stuff right there, that's right. Some of you ladies are like, will you close your mouth right now? Okay. See, here's the deal. I'm not even warmed up yet. Let's really get going, shall we, about why weddings are nuts. How much should a woman spend on a dress she wears once? It's a good question. Sometimes in my house, I have Say Yes to the Dress on my TV, and they're like, oh, we can't spend $25,000 on the dress. We need to spend $35,000 on a dress. And how many times is she going to wear it? How many of you think my wife even knows where her wedding dress is? Do you? You don't even know. Isn't that funny? There are lots of things like that. You know, why do we decorate the sanctuary for the wedding? The last wedding I did, 21 minutes, in and out. All these decorations. And I think, what in the world? Why do we do this? Now, what I really think is crazy, and this is just part of my rant, probably because my girls haven't got married yet, but the expectations around a wedding have changed over the last about 20 years. We were at a wedding recently that started at 2 p.m. and got done at 11. 2 p.m. to 11. Where along the way was the expectation that 9 hours of my life is going to be sucked away, never to be returned at a wedding? Why is that okay? And when did it become the expectation that if you go to a wedding, they're going to feed you a full meal? Whatever happened to ham sandwiches and those little minty things? Remember those little minty? When's the last time you went to a wedding and they had those little minty things? I love those minty things. They're never at a wedding anymore. Why is that? You know, my nephew's wedding, they didn't even have cake. They had donuts. And they had so many donuts left over, they could feed a police precinct. Sorry, Andrew. It's true. And of course, we could talk about shows like The Bachelor, 90 Day Fiancé, Say Yes to the Dress, my favorite. Now, the truth is that in so many of these shows that are so popular, there are so many not just non-biblical, but anti-biblical ideas, and yet they're popular among even Christians. Oh, there's so much more I could say. But here's my point, and here's why weddings annoy me to death. If couples would spend as much time, effort, and money on preparing for their marriage instead of trying to have a perfect wedding day, then maybe they would have the tools to make their marriage last. I cannot get past all the effort that goes into a wedding and how little effort goes into the marriage. And that, more than anything else, annoys me to death. It feels like we have things backwards. Like God's way and culture's way are opposite. And what's so funny is that the Bible gives us only basic instructions around what a wedding is. You know, leave your father and mother, cleave to your wife, cleave to your husband, the two become one flesh. It's about all we got when it comes to a wedding. But all the way throughout the Bible, it talks about how to have a great marriage. We spend all of the time getting ready for the wedding and spend little time getting ready for the marriage. Can we all just say that weddings are way easier than marriages? And you think in the moment when you're the one doing the wedding that this is so, you know, so hard and so expensive and they're so stressful. Just wait. It doesn't get easier. It gets way, way harder. So now that my little rant is over and the ladies are all grumpy at me, let's make it a little worse, shall we? And let's just put a little bit of honesty on the table. And I want to read for you, and I have it up here, a passage that I think would be great to read at every wedding that I never get to read ever at a wedding. Here's what it says. This is out of Romans 3. None is righteous, no, not one. Wouldn't that just be a great spot to begin at a wedding? No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they've become worthless. No one does good, not even one. I love it. I want these in the vows. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongue to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. I love that. We can make that poetic. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood, and their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Why do we not read this at a wedding? Oh, you guys are all thinking I'm nuts. But isn't this more honest than many things that we hear at a wedding? And you think, oh, I thought you were done with your aunt. No, I'm not. I am not done at all. And in fact, I would say that if we could slip some of these ideas into the vows, it would be fabulous. Instead of for better, for worse, why don't we say, do you take this liar, this deceiver, who will ruin you and cause you misery, to be your lawfully wedded husband? Why don't we do that? So it's almost as if we don't want the bride and groom to know what's about to come their way. And so we sugarcoat it and we beat around the bush and we smirk at the groom's distraction with the bride's beauty. And we know that they think that they have enough love to get through anything. And we all smirk because we know it's just not true. And yet we let couples go into their marriage believing that their love will be enough for anything, that they'll survive on love. And we know that it won't be enough. And I've often wondered, is the reason we want to have a perfect wedding, is it because we know it might be the only thing perfect ever in the marriage? Maybe. So this little rant maybe you think is totally unfair, but it leads me to what I believe to be probably the most overlooked and underappreciated aspect of marriage. And it really works for parenting the same way. And here it is. Never forget, husbands, that you married a dirty, rotten sinner, and so did she. Never forget that. And right along side by side with that is the idea that you guys as a married couple, as a married couple, as sinners, you're living in a broken world that is trying to do all that it can to rip you apart. That is the reality. But somehow we don't talk about this. And we allow other things to float their way in. So weddings are, they're full of lights and beauty and decorations. Marriages are filled with lots of opportunities for sinners to act like sinners. Both the bride and the groom bring things to the wedding and into their marriage, which has the potential to destroy them. And they all bring it. We brought it into ours, every single one of us. And then what happens is sometime, usually after the honeymoon, but definitely before the first anniversary, one or the other, or both, they wake up and they're like, oh my word, I married a sinner. I can't believe it. I married a sinner. And then they begin to realize that all of this marriage thing is so much harder than they expected it to be. Sin complicates everything in a marriage. Everything. And no one tells these couples this. And nobody tells that young couple that every single fight they have is really just a symptom of the much larger issue, which is sin. And so what that couple thinks is, yes, he was too insensitive, or he leaves his clothes laying around, or she's too sensitive and spends too much on clothes. The fight might be over whatever that issue might look like, but the real issue is always sin as it bubbles up through the realities of life. And so in my premarital counseling class, I always talk about the symptoms and the issues. And we spend so much time in fighting about all these symptoms up here when the real issue is sinners marry sinners. I did, she did, we're all a bunch of sinners. Why would we ever think that that sin isn't going to boil up in the day-to-day, everyday moments of our life? It's going to. And it's going to complicate everything. So couples, here's what I'd like you to do this week. We're coming up to Valentine's Day, and I'm sure all you men are spending time thinking about what you're going to get your wife for Valentine's Day. Maybe what you could do this week is to snuggle up next to your wife and get nice and close so she can smell your breath and brush your teeth beforehand, but snuggle in nice and close and come up right next to her ear and whisper, "You married a sinner and you're stuck with me." I want to put that on a Hallmark card. Instead of all the cheesy things that are on cards that we all end up buying anyway, you know, "I am a sinner and you're stuck with me for life." Wouldn't that be a great Hallmark Channel special for Christmas or something? You know, why don't they have that reality program? Call it "A Sinner in the Hands of an Angry Wife." That would be great. Coming soon. You see, I think the first step in understanding God's plan is, at one side, just to realize that the Bible is so practical when it comes to the realities of marriage. And part of that reality is realizing that I, as a sinner, am married to a sinner. And the second that I or you forget that, the next fight spills over and it just goes, everything goes to pot. Because we forget, I am a sinner married to a sinner. She's a sinner married to a sinner. We're going to show each other just how big of sinners we are. And we're going to have opportunities all the time to show that. And perhaps you think I'm being pessimistic. Or maybe you think I'm dashing the aspirations of our young people to get married. I would like to think that I'm being realistic. And I'm trying to save marriages before they fall apart or rescue some that maybe right now are on the brink. And I think that at some level, if we all affirm that we struggle with sin and we're married to somebody who struggles with sin and can be realistic around the reality of that, at some level it helps us understand what's really going on. Why she's really mad at me. Why I keep doing these things. Sin is the cause. And it will bubble up through all layers, all levels, and everything you guys and we all do as couples. Now, let's compare this reality with what we find in this Ephesians 5 passage. And so what I like to do is I'm going to save the specific wives and husbands and responsibilities and all of that for another time. And we'll talk about it. But here's what I want us to wonder at something here in this passage. I want to wonder with you why seven times in verses 22 and following, Paul says and compares marriage in some way to Christ. Why does he keep coming back to Christ? I mean, there's a part of reading this that is a little bit like talking to teenagers where you can't figure out what they're talking about because the train of thought doesn't like board at the station, right? So he jumps around several different ideas, and it's a little bit hard to follow, but he keeps coming back. Wives, talk, it's about Christ. Husbands, talk, it's about Christ, and now you're together, and it's about Christ, and you're trying to make this life, and it's about Christ. Seven times, he makes a comparison, husbands and wives and weddings, and not weddings, marriages, to Christ. And so what happens so often, and you guys have heard these sermons for, you know, weddings and the wedding messages, they always you know, talk about Ephesians 5, and you guys have heard all of these sermons. It feels a little bit like, you know, Paul, why don't you just say, wives do this, husbands do this, and you'll live happily ever after. Why keep bringing Jesus into the mix? Why keep saying this there's this Christ influence that permeates everything that is going on in the wedding? Doesn't that just muddy the issue? And I would say that it doesn't. And maybe you've heard things, you know, at a wedding or at a marriage conference. And Paul does say it here, that the marriage should reflect Christ's love for the church. That's almost right out of verse 25. And it's true, and I agree, and I hope you guys agree as well. And we're going to talk about some of those things. And, you know, the idea behind that is the husband can think, yeah, okay, she's annoying me today, but Christ loves his church even when we're annoying, so I can continue to love her. Or she can think, you know, does he really need to watch sports every day? Well, Christ loves the church, and so I don't need to nag him about it. And we can go that route, and we're going to talk about some of those things. But they all, I think, miss the big point of these verses. And the reason they miss the big point is because they try to get into the verse by verse and they want to list out the responsibilities and they miss the whole. And what they really miss, because they don't put them all together, is the idea that Christ must permeate all aspects of the marriage. Everything comes back to Christ. Everything comes back to displaying His glory, to imitating the way that He lived and lived back then, and the way He loves the church then and loves the church now. It all comes back to Christ. And so when we do things in the marriage as to the Lord, for the glory of the Lord, for His name's sake, because He did it that way, what Paul says is that's the way it should be. And if everything comes back to Christ, and you got to get this, this is the biggie, and all week I want you to wrestle with it. Here's the biggie for the passage and what is missed at so many weddings and so many marriage conferences. Marriage is about Christ, not about you. Marriage is about Christ, not about you. That's his big point here. And it's a profound mystery, he says. It's about Christ, and it's not about you. And so when you ask people, you know, why do you want to get married? This young couple, they're in love, and they say things, I love her, I can't live without her, and I want to grow old with him and have a family. You know, they say all these things. But from Paul's point of view, marriage, the union of marriage, the reason marriage exists is so that two rotten sinners get the chance every single day to show what marriage is really all about. Two rotten sinners that come together in this union, this marriage, that then have the chance every single day for the rest of their life to show what their marriage is really about. It's about Jesus, not about me. And every time we make it about ourselves, don't we all get into trouble? I think we miss that along the way, or at least we give it lip service. Marriage is about Christ. It's about His glory. It's about His name. And figuring out ways in the midst of the marriage, in the day-to-day, and the good and the bad, and all the things that come along, how can I show the majestic worth of Christ in this marriage, in this moment, in this fight, in the way I talk, in my attitude, in the way I treat her, in the way to forgive her? How do I allow Jesus to bubble up through the natural sin, natural man that I am, to allow it to bubble up so people go, that's really about Jesus, not about him? That, I think, is the struggle. That's where we fight. We want people to look at our marriage from the outside, and let's be honest, they are, and conclude something about the worth of Christ by what they observe in our marriage. That's what we really want. So take a look at this verse. I see my time's about done, but here's a great verse. And I've only ever heard this applied to individuals. I've never heard it applied to a marriage. 2 Corinthians 5:14. For the love of Christ controls us, because we've concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died. And he died for all, that those who live, this is the important part, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. And again, I've never heard this applied to marriage, and we always read everything individualistically, but this is, I think, a key for marriage. It is not for ourselves, but we have this marriage as this great gift and opportunity to show that we're not living for ourselves, but we're living for Him who died for us. We have this opportunity. And it's not just like, yes, I can go to work and do that. Yes, I can talk to and have friends and do this. Yes, and my choices, my entertainment, all those other things that we can do that can show the worth of Christ. But specifically this month, in our marriage, we have to see our marriage as an opportunity to show the worth of Christ through the good and the bad and the ugly. In fact, if you look back at Ephesians 5, I want to show you something that, again, almost never comes out as people talk about these things. Ephesians 5, 22 and following, 7 times it talks about or relates or compares marriage to, to, to Christ. But we always skip verse 21. 20 and 21. Giving thanks always and for everything to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. Now, there's some that argue that verses 22 and following are simply describing a part of doing verse 21 well. Submitting to one another because of Christ. How do I do that in my marriage? That's verse 22 and following. So an argument could be made that marriage is just a small part of the much larger question of how do I submit to each other for the name of Christ? How do I make Christ manifestly beautiful and admirable in the eyes of all that know me, all that see me, all that look at my life? And this question permeates all that we are, and marriage is one small part of that question. So the real point, I think, is that the glory of God is the ultimate aim of marriage. Your happiness is not. That idea right there could change your marriage. The glory of God is the ultimate aim of marriage. Your happiness is not. Yes, we're going to care for each other. We're going to love each other. We're going to grow old with each other and all of those things. But it leads to a very important question. In your marriage and in my marriage, whose kingdom shapes your marriage? Whose kingdom shapes your marriage? Because what happens whenever we talk about these things, the husband and the wife, we get in this mode of like, okay, give me a couple little nuggets to help things get a little bit better at home, or to help me improve a little bit with my marriage or with my kids, or how, you know, give me some really good like golden nuggets to so my kids grow up to love Jesus. And we talk about it in this way. But the real question behind this is, if the glory of God is the most important thing in my marriage and in my family, whose kingdom am I really trying to build? Whose kingdom shapes my marriage? Whose kingdom shapes my home? And if it's all about the glory of God, and if His big aim in my marriage is not my happiness but His glory, is my home and my house, my marriage, my family, is it being shaped by the kingdom of God, or is it being shaped by a culture that is hostile to the ideas of God? And I think that's a good question, because when we get married, we think things like, you know, I want to start a family, I want to build a home, I want to, you know, build this life together, all of those things, and those are fine thoughts. But I think if we're in our marriage and our families, what we're really trying to do is to control the outcomes, or, you know, have this own little, our own little safe world, or, you know, build our own kingdom, or maybe miraculously have these obedient children that always say please and thank you. What we're really trying to do is we're circumventing God's foundation for a marriage that honors Him, because we're trying to build our kingdom instead of using our marriage and family to build His kingdom. There's a difference. And so when people at a wedding or at a marriage seminar say, you know, and this is the idea, they talk about the joining of two worlds. No, it's not the joining of two worlds. It's the two becoming one, yes, but it's really the abandoning of two worlds to form a new kingdom, this new foundation, this kingdom that I'm trying to build that is all about Jesus. We get the idea wrong. And when we start wrong, it's like remodeling your house. It's a lot easier to build it right the first time. It's way more expensive to remodel it. So here's the picture that we have and the foundation for this entire month. Two rotten sinners decide they want to get married. And they recognize all the great opportunities they're going to have to show exactly how they are sinners and act like sinners. But they're going to be able to show that Christ really matters more than anything else. And if they decide then throughout their life, yes, we're going to mess it up, and yes, we're going to act like, you know, a bunch of selfish pigs all the time, but we're sinners, but we're building towards this kingdom, this foundation, this worth that is different. So no matter the cost, no matter the humility, no matter what I got to change to build His kingdom, not build my own kingdom, but build His kingdom, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to build His kingdom, even if it hurts, even if it damages my pride, I will do whatever it takes to build his kingdom. If we can start there with our young people, what different marriages they will have. And for a lot of us, we have a lot of remedial work to get back to that. So if we can embrace these two ideas, I'm a sinner who married a sinner, and marriage is about Christ, it's not about me. And if we can take these two like deep foundation points for our marriage and build our marriages and families on these two ideas, we begin to get the idea that I can, through my marriage, show the infinite worth of Christ to a world who thinks that the institution of marriage is dying. Somebody say this clearly. I want you to hear me very clearly. You can have a great marriage. Every single one of us can have a great marriage. Sometimes we think it's only for a select few. It's only for those that somehow achieve some certain level. If I can just say it simply, but not simplistically, very simply, when we follow God's ways, he builds a marriage that is satisfying to us and is ultimately for his glory. Now, for some of us, it's going to be harder than for others. A lot of us, we have far more baggage, and we have a harder time submitting ourselves to Christ. But you can have a great marriage. It's not something you have to wait for someday. If she would change these five things or he would stop doing those things, then we'd have a great marriage. You don't have to wait for that moment. Quite simply, I think, if you take hold of these two ideas, I'm a sinner married to a sinner. My marriage is about Christ, not about me. You can begin to go forward maybe in a whole different way than you've done in the past. So I believe that there is nothing that two people who love Jesus cannot overcome in their marriage if they both decide to submit to those two ideas. I'm a sinner married to a sinner. My marriage is about Christ, it's not about me. If they can do those things, I believe two people who love Jesus, there is nothing they cannot overcome. No matter how hard, no matter the issue, they can do it. So there's great hope. Now remember, you have two homework assignments. One I've given you. One, snuggle up next to your wife. Say, I'm a sinner and you're stuck with me for life. That's the first one. The second one, on your way out today, there are cards that look like this. A month of prayers for your wife. Husbands, I would encourage you, if you're up to the challenge, take this home. 30 days of things that you can pray for specifically for your wife. And there's the husband version. So husbands take the ones that say wife. The wives take the ones that say husband. But just a great way to pray for your spouse. They're at the doors on their way out. There'll be ushers there to hand them to you if you'd like them. That's part of your homework assignment. This entire month, we're going to be working on these things. And I want it to be just practical. You guys like me, we've sat through so many, just kind of fluffy things. But I believe that there are influences on our marriages now. And if we don't get serious, some of us, we're going to have troubles in the future. And I want to stop that if I can.